From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Tijuana when a woman and her friend were driving on a city street and they saw something fall out of the back of a pickup truck nearby. It was a black plastic bag. Looking closer, they could see inside was a dead body wrapped in that bag. Now, how would you feel if you saw something like this where you live? Sayak Valencia writes that for a friend in Tijuana, it is not shocking. It is all too common. Valencia writes about the way she sees violence becoming essentially a product, an actual product within a hyper-consumerist capitalist system. That body in the black bag is a kind of commodity. The drug industry is one of the largest industries in the world, and Valencia attempts to pull back the layers that prop it up. But not just the drug industry. Her book is called Gore Capitalism. She looks at the global rise of authoritarian governments, violence against women, loss of human rights, and the impact of violence on cities that have become hauntingly depopulated and dominated by violence. Valencia also turns her eye to masculinity, where she finds a link between misogyny and violence. Valencia is a professor and researcher in the Department of Cultural Studies at El Colegio de la Frontera Norte. She has recently been in Tijuana, and she's in Rochester as a guest of Nazareth College, where she will give a presentation this evening, and we have so much to talk about. First, let me say welcome to Sayak Valencia here to Connections. Thank you for being here.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having us.
You got it. Also with us is Reverend Nadia Mullen, a Protestant chaplain in the Center for Spirituality at Nazareth College. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Ana Gomez Parga is a professor of media and communication at Nazareth College. Ana, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And with us, two students, Sarah Schuler and Juliana Joyce, students at Nazareth College. Sarah is a former student leader for the Solidarity and Social Justice Retreat. And I'm sorry, Sarah and Juliana, who's the former and who's the current? Is that right?
Yes, I'm the former and Juliana is the
current, but I also have led it in the past.
All right. Thank you both for being here. And I know they're here to talk about not only their views on these related matters, but their recent experiences. Let me just kind of pull back first and ask our guests to tell us what's actually coming up tonight at 6 p.m. Is that right, Anna? I'll turn to Nadia then.
Okay. Yes.
6 o'clock
yes.
tonight. What's happening?
6 o'clock tonight, we're having our keynote lecture. Dr. Valencia will be presenting on her work at 6 p.m. in the Callahan Theater at Nazareth College. This event is free and open to the public, and we strongly encourage people to come out and have this opportunity to learn from Dr. Valencia and her work.
We'll also have four more guests, invited scholars from Latin American Studies. Dr. Lidia Huerta will be joining us from Reno, Nevada, and we'll have Dr. Isabel Cordova and Hilda Chacon.
All right, very good. So that's, again, 6 o'clock tonight.
Yes.
If you want to attend and can still do that. Okay, and Nadia and Ana, let me just ask briefly here. You know, you've got students in studio with us here who are going to be sharing their experiences. What are you hoping that students are able to gain through their experiences, either on the college campus and these kinds of discussions, but also in their travel and their experiences? What's been happening? Anna?
Okay, so for me, as a professor of communication and media, one of the things that I hear from students a lot is how much influence the media has in our lives, right? And that's not an easy question. And so what I want my students to get from this event is I want them to begin to understand that life is more complex than yes or no answers, that there are multi-layers, multi-layered problems, multi-layered solutions, everything is interconnected. And so hopefully this conversation will open the right questions and the right discussions about these events that affect us ultimately all of us.
What do you make of Sayak Valencia's work, especially Gore Capitalism? And it is the kind of work that cannot be summed up in a short paragraph. But I'll ask you, Ana, how it impacts you and what do you think, how should it impact sort of the national and international conversation?
Well, so I've been reading Sayak Valencia's work for 2 years now. And as a Mexican, as a migrant, as a woman, I can honestly tell you I have not been able to find another piece of work that dignifies Mexico in this way, because it portrays Mexico as people who have agency, who are caught between a system that is complex, but they're players and they have a say in what they do with their lives. But at the same time, sometimes when you're pushing against a system that's bigger than you, you have to question and wonder about a lot of things that happen around you. So I think it gives us the right vocabulary to begin to explain our existence, our lives, and it also names our problems in the way that no other work has.
Okay. Well, I'm going to turn to Ms. Valencia and I'll ask you first. The book is called Gore Capitalism. Is all capitalism Gore Capitalism? In other words, do you think capitalism can create societies where violence is sort of not commoditized, where we don't see hyper-consumerism?
Well, I will ask you in Spanish and then Ana will translate my thoughts. No, el capitalismo no es gore en todos los sitios, pero es verdad que la parte de la apropiación del cuerpo, la explotación y el, digamos, la forma de espectacular del derramamiento de sangre sí está en las bases del capitalismo y tiene que ver con el link colonial que tiene el capitalismo como un sistema no solo de producción, sino también un sistema de producción de subjetividad que está muy vinculado con el consumo, pero también ahora con el hiperconsumo. Y creo que puedo abundar en esta idea, pero quiero que pueda traducir.
Okay, so the first thing that she wants you to know is that capitalism, it does not take the gore form everywhere. It's only in certain spaces in the world, particularly those places that have colonial traces, where consumerism and subjectivity are also plays there for profit in a way, where bodies also become a form of merchandise profitable for certain purposes.
En este sentido, quería hablar del capitalismo gore como una metáfora visual también para poder impactar en la mente de los lectores que entienden mejor las imágenes a veces que un pensamiento articulado de otra manera. Y la palabra gore es muy específica para ver algo que tiene que ver con el derramamiento de sangre, con el espectáculo. Pero quería ponerlo como el lado B o la contraparte que nos toca en las fronteras y que nos toca en países como México, donde parece que todo es bárbaro, poco civilizado y que todo es espectacular, violento, machista, ¿no? Entonces era como un poco para hacer una metáfora de este sistema como visual en el que nos meten a todos los mexicanos, aunque no seamos todos eso.
So she wanted to offer a reflection, like you stand here watching capitalism and you can see yourself in the mirror and see the other side where there's a capitalism gore. And she borrows this gore concept from gore cinema, which is this grotesque display of violence and the spectacle of violence. And so she offered this concept as a way for you to sit and see how in the other side, this capitalism takes a different form where there's a spectacle of violence where you can sit here and see what's happening with a migrant caravan, with the war on drugs, with everything else. And all you can see is a spectacle of blood and victimhood and all of that.
But when it comes to, and forgive my perhaps very rudimentary understanding of some of the concepts, and I'd like to spend more time trying to absorb and understand. When it comes to, for example, one thing that our government focuses on a great deal is the drug trade, what they call the war on drugs. But there's this kind of pretending that it is a Mexico problem or it is a Central American problem when the flow of drugs internationally and the money and so much that goes with it is intertwined internationally. Do you find that in our country, in this country, I should say, in the United States, is there a feeling that we kind of pretend it's somebody else's problem, that we're not part of that system, or that we are trying to squash that system as opposed to understanding our role?
De hecho, es importante que entendamos que todo el capitalismo está conectado y que el capitalismo está conectado de una manera en donde las consecuencias nefastas o la mala prensa se queda casi siempre del lado de la frontera del sur.
Okay, so first of all, the first thing we need to understand is that capitalism is everywhere and it's interconnected. And then adding to that, there are colonial traces, right? So
En este sentido, lo que regularmente se desresponsabiliza a los gobiernos de los países del primer mundo, en este caso Estados Unidos, tiene una lógica y una política antidrogas que no es nueva, que es de los años 70 y que va acompañada también de una política de intervención a los diferentes gobiernos y a las soberanías en pos de una seguridad para Estados Unidos, pero también en pos para una seguridad impuesta a estos países. Entonces, no es.
So if you combine together the power of certain places like the United States along with the colonial traces, the capitalism, the effects on the war on drugs are tougher, more violent in certain places because of all these layers that keep accumulating.
Sí, pero la responsabilidad, creo que esto es importante, la responsabilidad de los países del norte y del consumo de drogas en los países del norte que hacen que haya una oferta y una demanda que es mucho más grande que solamente consumidores o productores, sino que hay unas políticas públicas ocultas dentro de ese gobierno. El dinero es adicto a las drogas, en el sentido de los sistemas de seguridad necesitan el problema de las drogas desplazado en otros lugares para poder seguir pidiendo presupuestos y para poder seguir pensando que la seguridad es necesaria de esta manera casi autoritaria.
One of the things that she feels they need to emphasize is that the responsibility of consumption and when it comes to policy with internal policy and policy making, she gives this phrase that money likes drug addiction in a way. They profit from each other. So there are certain policies being put in place for control, for any other political agendas that keep drugs illegal in a way as a way to... continue to exercise power over certain domains.
¿Puedo decir una cosa más? Que el problema de las drogas en México es la punta del iceberg, es el problema que se espectaculariza. Pero al interior de eso existen muchas mafias que tienen que ver con la explotación de los recursos naturales, con la explotación de las personas, pero también con economías legales como las mineras que explotan el oro, los recursos, todo esto, que también son parte de ese capitalismo, pero la única forma que vemos el capitalismo hacia afuera, el capitalismo gore de México, es de esta manera como de salvajes que no se saben gobernar a sí mismos. Sin embargo, esta es la como lo que vemos y abajo está la conexión con el capitalismo.
So if I can take you back to that metaphor of you standing here and just watching the spectacle of violence at Mexico, what's happening in Mexico right now, what you're seeing is only at the tip of the iceberg. If you look deeper, you will see that along with drug cartels and drug trafficking, there are a lot of other industries benefiting from these. There are exploitation, there are other forms of legal industries are also taking place that serve in a way or connect with drug trafficking in ways that we don't necessarily understand because we're just caught in this fantasy of watching the violence that happens with cartels and in this discourse of this is just people being salvaged and just attacking each other, being violent because that's who they are.
So sometimes you hear a sort of proposal for a simple solution, legalize drugs. Everything goes away. The criminal activity goes away. The violence goes away. The international problems go away. Does that oversimplify? How do you feel about that?
Creo que legalizar las drogas es una cosa importante, pero tenemos que pensar la droga no como una sustancia o como varias sustancias que alteran la conciencia, sino la droga como un dispositivo político que articula la economía, la cultura y una serie de cuestiones que se vuelve un dispositivo de gobierno autoritario. Ahora creo que se podría legalizar la droga y no va a pasar nada en ese sentido, va a ser una política afortunada. Pero, y tengo otra cosa que decir sobre eso.
So drugs are a political device. They're being used for political purposes. So we need to start thinking about drugs in that way. They move the economy. They move discourse. They move power. So we need to start having those conversations. And if I may, I just want to add something as my own interpretation of Sayek's words. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think it's the most valuable contribution from her work is that she takes us away from these easy conversations of having to find who's guilty and how do we fix it. And so if we actually get to read her book, which I recommend, we will begin to actually see and start opening our eyes to how complex and how involved pretty much everybody is. And one of the things I tell my students is I myself, as a consumer, the things I buy and the exploitation that comes with whatever it is that I consume is helping these forms of, it's forcing people to, first of all, being displaced from one place to the other, and second of all, getting engaged in those kinds of illegal activity.
So...
Perdón.
Oh, sí, sí.
Can I? Lo que quería decir es, se ha transformado, las drogas se van a legalizar porque va a ser rentable legalizarlas, pero ahora el negocio van a ser las migraciones y los desplazamientos forzados, por ejemplo, la caravana. Creo que esa es la nueva forma del capitalismo gore contemporáneo. Ya no van a ser las drogas y los cárteles, ahora son las personas desplazadas y el dispositivo de gobierno de la migración.
So what she's anticipating is that well, she told us that drugs are a political device that move power, the economy, and discourse, right? But what she sees is that now that drugs are being legalized, what's now being used as a political device will be the people. And that's the name of capitalism, Gore, the bodies of people from the migrant caravan, for example. Those are the bodies that will be used as merchandise, as tokens, as mechanisms of politics, of discourse, of power, and everything else.
And so when it comes to changing systems, when it comes to really changing fortunes and giving people a chance to live in societies that are not dominated by violence, there are a lot of discussions within this country about what, first of all, the role of the United States should be, I guess the role of the consumer, as Anna describes. I mean, all of the personal responsibility that comes into the choices we make, from the clothing we buy to whether we're consuming drugs, et cetera. And I understand that. But sometimes you will hear folks say things like, well, we shouldn't get involved. If they want to, you know, if they want social change, they need to enact that kind of change. But it, at least from my perspective, when there's this much violence, there's this much risk to trying to change violence for people who have so little power, let alone safety and security, what realistic hope is there to see that kind of change, to move away from what you would call Gore capitalism? What do you think sort of the ingredients or the steps would be to take us away from what you perceive as Gore capitalism?
Sí. Creo que lo que me pregunta es muy importante, pero a ver, un momento. Creo que no hay una respuesta definitiva para eso, pero sí considero que tenemos que, lo que el libro quiere es ver cómo el capitalismo Gore también articula colonialismo, misoginia, cómo articula también subjetividad capitalística o hiperconsumo, y también cómo podemos hacer formas de resistencia, porque en el libro sí hablo de formas de resistencia que no pasan por la política tradicional, sino por la construcción de comunidades más pequeñas.
So capitalism enforces several things. Number one, colonial traces. Number two, misogyny. It serves capitalism. Number three, hyperconsumerism. Mm-hmm. And then, but there's also another four that we usually don't talk about, which is resistance. Capitalism also offers resistance.
No el capitalismo Gore en sí, sino las formas de resistencia que se van articulando en comunidades como Cherán, en pueblos indígenas, con movimientos feministas, que eso no se espectaculariza. Y también creo que debo decir una cosa muy importante, el capitalismo Gore no es solamente propiedad evidentemente de México o de los países del tercer mundo, sino que se vuelve un producto cultural. La narcocultura se vuelve un producto cultural desde que Breaking Bad es la serie más vista de los Estados Unidos, y desde que se iconizan y se glorifican héroes que se dedican al narcotráfico también. ¿Cómo traspasa estas fronteras? ¿Cómo los narcos de México son sucios y morenos y bárbaros, mientras que Mr. White es un genio de la química?
Okay, so capitalism transforms phenomena into culture. So for example, if we think right now about the drugs and cartels and illegal activity, we can think about Breaking Bad, for example. And so capitalism is not something that's only happening in Mexico. It spreads to other places because of this ability of capitalism to turn everything into culture, to normalize things until they become culture.
And normalize violence.
And it normalizes violence, yes.
And I have a new concept that I'm writing right now. It's a necroscopy, or like the perspective of the vision of the necro, but it's not like just death. It's about, many things about related with violence and other stuff, and how that necroscopy makes builds a common sense, really desensitizes with violence and with death, and that it's that is a product. It's Breaking Bad, but also Narcos, also many other of the cultural industries are participating of this exploitation of the Gore capitalism. And for me, it was really important, not just the fact that the capitalism is a drug traffic and mercenary and other stuff, but it was like it is constructing a way of thinking and a subjectivity that we share around the world.
Can you tell us more about how you see the link of capitalism and misogyny, and how?
Okay.
She's just letting me know that I will be translating.
Oh, I see. how you see that link, and does capitalism profit from misogyny? Does it create or sort of fuel misogyny? How have you seen that link?
Okay, tenemos que regresar al la cultura. No solo mexicana, pero en general vivimos una cultura desigual en poder hacia las mujeres y hacia los hombres. Y lo voy a tratar de decir fácilmente.
Okay, so first of all, let's go back and look at history. So we have to start from history, and we don't have a story of men and women being equal. Let's start there.
Pero no siempre fue así. Hay un cambio en la Edad Media, que es cuando empieza a la Casa de Brujas, que dura 3 siglos, y que Silvia Federici, en su libro Calibán y la Bruja, habla muy bien de la domesticación de las mujeres y de cómo les quitaron el poder.
So, Silvia
Federici.
Federici offers this story about how, from the Middle Age, it started to become that way, to begin this inequality between
men
and women.
It wasn't always that way.
Yes, it wasn't always that way.
It wasn't always.
So for SAIAG, one of the things, and I know this from now that we have been talking, it's always important that we go back to history so that we understand that none of this is normal. It started somewhere and for a reason.
Sí, todas las cuestiones todas las cuestiones morales y de género tienen razones económicas.
Every issue that's related to gender, it's based on economy and power.
Y tengo algunos otros como ensayos donde hablo de la relación del cuerpo de las mujeres como acumulación originaria que no se paga, el cuerpo y el trabajo de las mujeres, el trabajo sexual, el trabajo doméstico, todo, la reproducción.
So if we think of women, we think of unpaid labor. Like reproduction, for example, like work, housework, all of that, it's labor, but it's free labor.
Y la propiedad del cuerpo de las mujeres fue algo que pasó, que le dieron a los hombres en la Edad Media, y a los hombres colonizados les dieron a las mujeres para restituir las tierras robadas. Entonces,
so during the Middle Ages, women were given to men, especially for men of color, for instance, because they took away the land, so they got women. So women were became these kind of merchandise and bodies that were given as a way to begin this form of capitalism that
que tiene que ver con el colonialismo, la conquista. Le dieron a los hombres, los hombres racializados les dieron a las mujeres, pero los hombres blancos y los colonizadores tenían a los dos, a las mujeres y a los hombres racializados.
So if we go back to colonial history, men who were colonized got women, but men who were colonizers got land and women.
Y esto es importante porque la masculinidad no siempre fue así como la conocemos, no siempre fue misógina y no siempre fue depredadora. Esa es una masculinidad necropolítica y es una masculinidad que tiene que ver con la conquista y con la supremacía. Hay otras masculinidades.
This new masculinity that we're talking about now, that's oftentimes referred to as toxic masculinity, Sayak calls this necromasculinidad, which is something related to death. And it has to do with being a predator, a killer, violent towards women especially. And if we take the example of Mexico, we have the phenomenon of femicides, for instance.
Pero esto está como relacionado con el hecho de que los hombres tienen que vigilar a las mujeres para no vigilarse a sí mismos y seguir cumpliendo el mandato de género. La masculinidad como proyecto político destructor, no toda la masculinidad, se ha apoderado del cuerpo de los varones para que ellos sean quienes hagan estos destrozos y haya una responsabilidad de género individual y no se vea la estructura del sistema que controla los dos géneros. Entonces, la misoginia es un sistema de control de los dos géneros donde el que ejerce la violencia renta para el Estado, pero también tiene ciertos privilegios.
So if we look at this system, and I'm trying to do justice to her words, but she's way smarter than I am. So we can think about capitalism as this system that's trying to expand, but it doesn't want to do it, obviously. So what it does is it colonizes men, and it convinces them to think that, okay, you can gain status, for example, if you control your women, if you control your resources, if you control whatever it is that you own. So for some men, you don't own land, you don't own profit, but you own women. At least culturally, that's the accepted way of doing it. So men have been convinced to become these sort of violent predators, controllers. So they do the hard work, or the dirty work for capitalism. So when we look at the problems of violence, we can think that, oh, it's men in Mexico or men in Latin America or undereducated men. But no, it's men trying to gain status in a system that's telling them you either get this status or you don't count or you're not visible. So that's kind of what's happening.
O no eres un hombre.
Or you're not a man.
niega completamente las personas, ¿no?
And that kicks them away from masculinity, which is like the ultimate humiliation.
Okay. And so, you know, again, forgive the simplicity of the question. But what can we do to change that?
Bueno, para empezar, saber que no siempre fue así y que toda la masculinidad y la feminidad no son proyectos políticos que son modificables y que en este, sí.
Okay, so first of all, she would invite us to come to terms with the fact that he was never, this is not natural, it started somewhere and we need to learn our history. And number two, both masculinity and femininity as they stand are political projects.
Y que lo que la invitación es a desobedecer las lógicas cuando esas lógicas destruyen a los otros y nos destruyen a nosotros mismos.
So she would invite you to disobedience if those projects end up in destruction or invite you to destruct the other.
Y también la masculinidad, para empezar, que la gente no se ofenda por un anuncio de Gillette.
To begin with, you can start by not being offended by a Gillette announcement. So.
by the Gillette ad? Is that what you did?
Yeah. But it was, I think the men are changing a lot. And I think the purpose of this invitation is make public when you are changing and make it visible. Because there is a lot of men disobeying this toxic masculinity, but we just have notice of the toxic masculinity. So we have to be together.
We have to champion the men who are currently disobedient in a toxic masculinity or destructive masculinity. We have to champion those men as well.
Okay, and so Sayak, I don't mean to get us sidetracked, but I am fascinated by one thing that's kind of stuck in my mind here, which is that you reference the Gillette ad, which certainly got people talking. And listeners, if you haven't seen the Gillette ad, which you probably have, but if you have not, it's about a 2-minute ad in which you see men in various places responding to other men who are engaging either in acts of violence, catcalling women, and other men stepping in to say, not cool anymore. It ends now. It stops. Telling young children, you don't have to fight physically over it. That's not how you handle things. And of course, there was some backlash. But some of the backlash, there's a separate category of backlash, said, it's a good message, but I don't need it from a profit-seeking corporation, which is trying to sort of, do you view that as a legitimate criticism, or do you think, hey, in a capitalist society, if someone's going to be making the money, we should make the money off of the idea that we need to end toxic masculinity. How do you see that?
Creo que es importante lo que pone. Se polariza la discusión, pero sin embargo creo que nadie está fuera del capitalismo, por un lado.
Well, to begin with, no one's outside of capitalism. Let's start there.
Y por el otro, creo que las poblaciones jóvenes, que es a quienes está dirigido este anuncio, entienden el mundo de una manera mucho más visual y mucho más directa, que el anuncio cumple ese cometido y que, por supuesto, está rentando, está creando beneficios para una marca así. Y creo que la crítica probablemente venga de como de la izquierda más tradicional y del marxismo más tradicional o de cuestiones que no quieren.
So this criticism is justified and it may come from people who lean more towards the political left, mm-hmm. Especially those Marxists who have legitimate reasons to criticize the ad.
Con lo que yo concuerdo.
However, but there is an important rhetorical and visual value here, which is that young people learn from whatever visual input ad that they're seeing. So the message is good and it's it has a lot of value in terms of a pro-social message, yes?
Eso pasa también con el feminismo. Mucho feminismo, que yo soy feminista, quiere que el discurso sea impoluto y que todo sea al pie de la letra, como lo dijo Simone de Beauvoir. Pero si Beyoncé dice que es feminista, probablemente mi sobrina de 10 años sea feminista por Beyoncé y no por Simone de Beauvoir, pero nos encontramos en ese mismo camino.
So she personally stands where, okay, first of all, no one is outside of capitalism. Period. Mm-hmm. So if she herself considers herself a feminist, a trans feminist, actually.
Yeah,
so you have Beyoncé, for example, saying that she is feminist and she has a lot of criticism because she's also very capitalistic. But at the same time, she says, well, if it wasn't for Beyoncé, my niece would not consider herself feminist. So there is value in that.
Y ese es el punto de inicio. No se termina la discusión ahí. Ese es el principio.
There is value as long as that's the starting point.
I think that's very well said. I know I'm late for our only break, and what I want to do is come back from this break, and we're going to talk to the students in the room about their experiences and how they view these issues, and want to remind you that our guest that you're hearing in studio today, Sayak Valencia, who's a professor and researcher in the Department of Cultural Studies at El Colegio de la Frontera Norte and the author of Gore Capitalism, is at Nazareth College today. You've been hearing Ana Gomez Parga, professor of media and communication at Nazareth College, and Reverend Nadia Mullen, Protestant chaplain in the Center for Spirituality at Nazareth College. They are ready if you want to join them tonight at 6 p.m. at Nazareth College in the Callahan Theater for presentation. The lecture is going to be given in Spanish, a lot like you're hearing today. Obviously, Sayak speaks very good English, but she's going to... En los dos?
En los dos.
Okay, so you'll hear both. So it's a great opportunity to hear more from Sayak if you'd like to do that tonight, 6 p.m. So let's get that break. We're going to come back and we'll hear from the student perspective next. Coming up in our second hour, the producers of the long-running hit show The Family Guy recently announced that they will not write any more jokes about homosexuality. They say it's not just that the world has changed, they say they have changed. And they don't find it funny anymore just to joke about someone's identity. Well, that set off a conversation among people who write comedy. Where should the lines be? What's reasonable? We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. You can find Gore Capitalism and various places. Speaking of capitalism, Amazon makes a little bit of money, and you can find it on Amazon, just as an example. And let me read the first review I saw in there, just as an example of what people may find in a book like Gore Capitalism. The reviewer writes the following, quote, "Everyone I know is finally asking, what the hell is going wrong in this country? Frantically searching for deep truth in books like Fire and Fury, House of Trump, House of Putin, and pre-ordering Bob Woodward's new book. I read all these books too, but if, like me, you want to really cut to the bone of what is happening and why things have deteriorated so starkly, first in emerging nations, but obviously in other parts of the world as well, you must look a lot deeper than our pathetic current headlines. Go back perhaps four decades and look not just at our recent decisions, but the chain reaction of decisions we have been making for four decades. Gore Capitalism is a great place to begin that search. There is a connection between the femicides in Ciudad Juarez and our trade and drug policies here in the United States, and many other unsettling connections as well. Thank you to this author for exposing me to an entirely new kind of literature." So there is a review that I suspect Sayak Valencia would say is at least heartening, yeah, as an author, to read that this is impacting people in a way that is making them think in new directions. Is that part of the goal, I guess?
Yes, of course. Open the conversation.
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful review there. So let me ask the students who are in the room, Juliana Joyce, Sarah Schuler. They're both students at Nazareth College, and they've worked on solidarity and social justice retreats, and both of you have traveled to the border. And again, I will start with Sarah. Tell us about trips to the border that you've taken. Go ahead.
So the trips that we've taken through Nazareth College mm-hmm. are focused on solidarity and social justice in a sense of bearing witness and listening to people's stories. A lot of people ask me, why would you spend your spring break going to some far off place in the border where it's challenging? And I say right back to them, I say, because it's important, because it's relevant. I have learned a lot about myself on these trips, in recognizing how, as a student, as an individual, learning about these issues that relate to me is important, to get the facts right, to hear people's stories and connecting in that way. And I think it's a challenge that only some people can find themselves up to take. I know that as a result of going on this trip for the past 2 years, I find myself growing in many different aspects of my life, in trying to be more open to listening to people's individual stories and finding a way to connect to them. A lot of students or individuals that I've talked to are also confused as to why I would go on a trip, because, you know, being in Rochester, New York, why would that concern me, something in El Paso, Texas, or in Mexico? And I say to them that it doesn't matter the distance between where a problem's going on, it relates to you, and there's something that you can do about it.
So you've taken two trips?
Yes, yes.
Both during spring break?
Yes.
2017 and 2018?
Correct.
Okay. And where exactly did you go?
So we traveled to El Paso, Texas, and we stay at the Columban Mission Center. And Father Bob Mosier is our lovely guide down there who travels with us in El Paso, Texas, and we spend 2 days across the border in Juarez, Mexico. And we talk to a wide range of people to hear their perspectives. We have the chance to speak with diocesan legal aides who work with people in the U.S. in Texas. We had a chance to sit in on court cases. We spoke to Border Patrol agents. We talked to organizations in Juarez who are focused on the community. So a wide range of opinions and perspectives.
I imagine whenever you take a trip like this, you find that reality is probably more complex than the media portrayals. And also there are some significant misunderstandings we may have about a number of things. Did you find that? What stands out to you?
Most definitely, I agree. I think a lot of times what you see in the news a lot of times becomes desensitizing. So you don't want to keep watching all of this violence that happens or things are misrepresented. And I think that's why it's so important to immerse yourself in the situation as best you can, whether it's on a trip to these places or trying to find stories for people who've actually experienced them themselves. And I think a lot of times once you're in that situation to challenge the stereotypes or misrepresentations mm-hmm. found in media and the news, you can figure out for yourself what the truth is behind it. What's going on?
What are we routinely getting wrong then in the media?
I think that's kind of a really complex question because it goes back to how we view someone who's different from ourselves, how we view the mm-hmm. other. Mm-hmm. In America, we have this tendency to distance ourselves. We stick to what's comfortable, what's familiar, and for that reason, a lot of stereotypes are found, a lot of implicit biases. Even within myself, I've been challenged to come to face-to-face with and ask myself, you know, I thought I was better than this, but actually realizing, you know, we all make mistakes, we're all human, but it's what you do with that information that really counts.
Okay, let me ask your colleague the same kind of questions then. Did you attend both the last 2 years?
So I attended the very first year, and then I was abroad in the previous okay. year. But I am very excited to be returning to the border on this year's retreat.
And tell me about your sort of perceptions on the, and how long, by the way? Was it most of the week, or how many days did you go?
I believe it was the full week we
okay.
were there.
Yeah. And so what stands out to you? Tell me about the experience.
So my personal experience, my first time at the border, I came in with a lot of questions and I left with a lot of questions. And I think that's a really important emphasis of the trip is, as Sarah beautifully explained, that it is the presence. Our service is bearing witness and hearing the stories of the migrants and the community members and just really taking that into account and realizing the intersectionality of everything. And Dr. Valencia's work also does a wonderful job of portraying how interconnected we all are. As Sarah mentioned, we went to Border Patrol, we went to Immigration Court, but we also learned a lot about environmental injustice and public health. And coming back to Rochester, I found myself questioning, like, why are things the way they are? Like, why are we systemically oppressing others? And just realizing that, once again, as Sarah said, no matter how far away we are, these issues are still relevant. When you think of the migrant worker, you think of who's harvesting our food, who's contributing to our agricultural climate. It's the migrant workers, which is very relevant to Rochester. I mean, we have so many apple orchards near us. And as our Catholic chaplain, Jamie Fazio, says, the real crux of the trip is turning facts to faces and stories to statistics. So I'm really curious to go back to see what's changed, what's remained the same, to continue to hear stories and to continue to educate myself. Because I'm sure even after last year, I'm not going for a year, like so much has changed dramatically. And I think it's important more than ever that we continue to hear these stories and that we continue to share these stories in our realms of influence.
I've gone 46 minutes without saying the word wall or Trump. So I'm going to try to stay away from that mostly, but I do want to ask the students about something that I read recently. The New York Times have recently hired Jamel Bowie as one of their columnists, and he's an African-American writer who's done a lot of work for Slate recently and now writing for The Times. And his first column as a Times columnist was on his view that this call for a wall is simply a signal and a symbol of white supremacy. And the part of the reason is, when we talk about the complexity of interconnected systems, when Dr. Valencia says, you know, we are all within capitalism and it impacts everyone and your purchasing choices impact people and all of these different things that happen interconnect in different ways. And it's complex. I mean, life at the border is undeniably complex, etc. Bowie is saying, no one in this administration is interested in complexity. They don't want to understand that complexity. What they want is to distill into fear, and the fear based of something that is different than you. And the idea that a simple wall is going to fix and keep out what is different or dangerous. When statistics show, for example, that people who come into this country from other places are not more violent than people who live in this country, do not commit more crime than people who live in this country. That doesn't mean there's not moments and incidents of violence. So the bottom line is I want to ask your view, having now spent time there trying to think about these complex, difficult things. You read Dr. Valencia's work. Do you agree with Bowie that right now at this moment, what Washington's focused on is actually a symbol of white supremacy?
I'd have to agree with you there, just because the wall in itself, walls are boundaries, and as you said, they're in itself implicit of othering. And a huge component of what we learned on this trip is to see past that, see past your own biases, see past the media and how they distort stories, and to truly see people for who they are, to look beyond all of that. And personally, I just think building a further boundary, you're not addressing the dire human needs of starvation and hunger and thirst. You're just casting it aside, casting the Maslow's hierarchy of needs aside, and out of your own fear of the unknown.
Okay, Sarah?
I agree with everything that Jules was actually saying. I do think that by having this campaign to build a physical wall, we finally reached this point of saying we do want to physically divide ourselves from what is different and what we feel uncomfortable coming to terms with. And I think we're finally at this point, unfortunate as it is, that it's so centered around anger and hatred and violence, but finally getting to the point of conversation to say, look what's going on between each other, like between myself and someone else. And I think, you know, a wall is a really powerful symbol for division between human beings that exists today.
I will also tell listeners, again, I'm just asking the students, based on a column that appeared in the New York Times, not personally as the host of this program to endorse any of those viewpoints, but I will point out that column got a lot of pushback from, generally speaking, conservatives, and it got a lot of thumbs up from white nationalists. White nationalists will generally, and we try to actually engage this subject in good faith, believe it or not, white nationalists will tell you, yeah, that's about right. That's what the wall is to us. It's a symbol. It's a symbol that says we can start dividing. So, Dr. Valencia.
Quiero hacer tres puntualizaciones sobre el muro. En Tijuana ya tenemos tres muros, entonces van a desperdiciar su dinero. Uno.
Okay, so she wants to clarify a few things. Number one, there is a wall already in Tijuana.
Three.
So you're going to spend your money, you're going to waste your money because it's there. Number two.
Número dos, la política supremacista blanca trata de distraer, eso es política supremacista blanca, pero el muro no está solamente en la frontera, el muro está dentro de las ciudades, y eso es lo peligroso de la idea del muro de Trump, que está haciendo muros internos y dividiendo a las poblaciones adentro.
So white supremacy is not just an ideology, it's also a distraction mechanism. So it's not just about a wall at the border. There are currently walls being built between people inside of the country. People are being divided. And the attention is being placed somewhere else.
Y la tercera es que la construcción de muros es una política internacional que está utilizando como ejemplo Estados Unidos, porque hay una política de la OCDE, que dice que para 2050 o así, la mayor parte de las ciudades europeas y del primer mundo tienen que estar murificadas, igual que en la Edad Media. Y esto es el pistoletazo de salida para crear una política aceptable de esa murificación.
So there is a political project which says that by 2050, every single first world country in the world will have its walls. So I think that what Dr. Sayak is telling us is that the United States is officially starting that race for who builds the wall first.
Let me take a phone call from a listener who wanted to send a message to the students. It's Jim in Rochester. Go ahead, Jim.
Mid-afternoon. I want to congratulate the two young ladies from Nazareth College, because what they're doing and what they have experienced is extremely important for the future of this nation. I hope you can bring some colleagues around with you. And I want to say also, as you move forward in advancing your career, I would hope you would consider a career in the State Department. You would be an excellent diplomat, statesman, because you have to have a global perspective, and we can't look within, we have to look without. And I think the Japanese society personifies that. For the first time in their 2,000-year history, they finally figured out that they have a problem, and they're immigrating people from wherever they can find them to keep their country and their culture and their society viable. That's all I have to say, and congratulations, and keep the good work up.
All right, Jim, thank you for the phone call. And just in our last few minutes, let me squeeze in one email from a listener who wanted to know from Dr. Valencia. And I'm going to take the listener's question and build it into some of the themes Dr. Valencia has been talking about when it comes to capitalism. If you cannot remove capitalism from our society, can you look at what's happening in, the listener wants to know your thoughts on Venezuela. He's wondering, if the United States intervenes, should we be suspicious that it's about control of oil, as opposed to saying, you know, outside of the bounds of capitalism, would actions be viewed differently? What do you think?
Creo que tenemos que hacer bien como la distinción entre el capitalismo es la norma genérica para hablar de este sistema, que es un sistema de producción, pero también existe el capitalismo financiero y el neoliberalismo, y creo que son tres cosas distintas.
Okay, so let's make a distinction between a few concepts. Capitalism as a system of production, and then capitalism as a financial system, and then there is neoliberalism.
Y que no solamente son, hablo de capitalismo porque me voy como a la raíz de este fenómeno, pero no hay una distinción. A ver, voy al capitalismo como una forma de hacer converger o interseccionar colonialismo, masculinidad tóxica, desposesión y también racismo.
Okay, so those are three different concepts. But when she's using capitalism, she's using it as a way to embrace four different concepts, which is misogyny, and then
racismo.
Racism.
Y también una forma de gobernanza como psicosocial, o sea.
A form of psychological governance
Y también un sistema de producción.
And it's a system of production.
Ahora mismo, después de los años 80 con el neoliberalismo, ya no hay una distinción tan clara entre qué es comunismo o qué es no capitalismo como sistema político, que sería Venezuela, y el capitalismo. Creo que aunque se acabe el capitalismo o lo que están diciendo sobre Venezuela y el petróleo, creo que sí, que es una forma de intervención. Se replican las fórmulas de los años 70 de intervención de los gobiernos del primer mundo sobre el sur para justamente gobernar sus recursos. Venezuela no tiene solo petróleo. Venezuela tiene coltán. El coltán ahora es más importante que el petróleo. El coltán es lo que tenemos en los celulares y lo necesitan para todo. Eso es lo que han destruido. No me acuerdo ahora qué país de África está completamente destruido por el coltán, porque se necesita el coltán. Entonces, el petróleo es un pretexto, pero hay muchas otras cosas.
Okay. So within this form of capitalism, yes, it's always for the look for resources. So yes, of course, this is an intervention for resources, not just for oil, but for
coltan.
Coltan. I don't know what the word is
for mineral. English.
It's a mineral, and it's used to make cell phones and all that. So what she sees is not just an intervention for oil, which is the obvious reason, but yes, other resources in Venezuela. But it's history again. It's an intervention from the first world into the third world for resources, which ultimately will cause more violence and displacement.
Okay, and finally, only about 30 seconds, do you find yourself becoming more optimistic and or perhaps less hopeful when you travel, when you write, when you consider what's happening?
Soy optimista, como transfeminista creo que soy optimista porque aunque haya backlashes significa que estamos avanzando.
So as a transfeminist, she is optimistic because every backlash is a symbol that we're moving forward.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for being here, and I want to remind you, Nadia, Anna, tonight, 6 o'clock, is that right? One more time, where can people go?
Okay, it's 6 p.m., Callahan Theater. There will be a simultaneous translation that we've prepared for all of you, and we'll have four professors from Latin American Studies along with Sayak Valencia.
I want to thank Sayak Valencia. Dr. Valencia is a professor and researcher in the Department of Cultural Studies at El Colegio de la Frontera Norte, and the author of Gore Capitalism, which you can find now. Dr. Valencia, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for it.
Thank you. Our thanks to Ana Gomez Parga, professor of media and communication at Nazareth. Thank you, Ana.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Our thanks to Reverend Nadia Mullen as well. Thank you, Reverend. Nice having you.
Thank you.
And to the students, Juliana Joyce, Sarah Schuler. Thanks for sharing your perspective and for being here this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Short break. More connections coming up.